Jesus had a checkered history with the Sabbath. For someone who was eventually called the Lord of the Sabbath and was worshipped on the Sabbath day, Jesus did not approach the observance of the Sabbath with the culturally expected reverence or respect. On multiple occasions, it seems as if Jesus completely ignored the Sabbath in order to do his work. He healed a man with a withered hand. He healed a woman who was crippled. He told a man to carry his pallet. He spit into the dirt and made clay and put it on a blind man's eyes to restore his sight. And he allowed his disciples to pick wheat, all on the Sabbath day. In every instance, the Pharisees and religious leaders would call his actions illegal. And we are told it was one of the main reasons that they wanted to kill him. For many, these stories prove that Jesus intended to depart from Judaism and to eliminate the Sabbath entirely. But this interpretation of Jesus' relation to the Sabbath is a serious mistake. Jesus did not obliterate the Sabbath, but reframed it and expanded it in ways that helped to renew and fulfill its deepest meanings. Of course, sometimes reframing and expanding an idea feels like destruction or loss to those who are wedded to the way things are, wedded to the status quo, wedded to celebrating things that always have been celebrated. Like the Pharisees, for instance. The standard trope, of course, is that the Pharisees were very legalistic in their observance of the Sabbath. But in reality, they had wildly departed from the Sabbath's original intention. In Judaism, the Sabbath originally had five components: creation, rest, liberation, justice, and peace. Born out of the Genesis narrative where God created the earth and the Exodus narrative where God liberated the Israelites from captivity in Egypt, Sabbath was a practice of creativity, work stoppage, freedom from slavery, justice for all people, and the restoration of a right relationship with all living things, or what the Jews call shalom. Of all five of these dimensions of the meaning of the Sabbath, the Pharisees chose to focus on only one: rest, the cessation of activity or work stoppage. And even that, they interpreted in a very narrow way that only benefited the powerful among them. Any activity that could be construed as work was forbidden, no matter what the reason. Taking yourself or requiring anyone else to take you to the doctor, for instance, was forbidden. However, the Pharisees had a legitimate legal bone to pick with Jesus. Allowing the disciples to pick grain was most definitely an act of work, which is why the Pharisees asked Jesus an obvious question. Why are they doing what is not lawful? We must remember here that the Sabbath was not just the religious law, but the political law of the land as well, like blue laws in America, which prohibited the buying and selling of certain goods on Sundays. Some of you still remember blue laws, I think. Even when they were long gone, my mother would say, "I don't know where you're going on Sunday afternoon. Nothing will be open." I said, "Mom, it's 2018. I mean..." Jesus was a lawbreaker. And worse than that, he supported and defended his disciples breaking the law. To the Pharisees, his actions must have seemed like an insurrection. They said, "Why don't you and your disciples have respect for the law? Breaking the law is wrong. Good people don't break the law. They keep the law. People of faith and religious leaders especially should uphold the law more than anyone else, shouldn't they?" Yes. Pharisees had a point. People of faith should respect and uphold the law, if the law is just. On the other hand, theologians like Thomas Aquinas and others throughout the ages have always said that if the law is unjust, then people of faith have a moral obligation to oppose it. This week, You may know the Attorney General combined religious and political law together and appealed to the Bible to justify the separation of immigrant children from their mothers and fathers at the border. He said, I would cite to you the Apostle Paul and his clear and wise commands in Romans 13 to obey the laws of the government because God has ordained the government for his purposes. He went on to say, orderly and lawful processes are good in and of themselves. Consistent and fair application of the law is in itself a good and moral thing that protects the weak. It protects the lawful. Our policies that can result in short-term separation of families are not unusual or unjustified. This is not only untrue, but a horrific misinterpretation of Romans 13. And it just happens to be the exact way the very same scripture was used by white supremacists to justify slavery, Nazi rule, unjust wars, apartheid in South Africa, and Jim Crow, as well as to justify other times in American history when we separated children from their parents, from the parents of Native Americans, African slaves, or Japanese immigrants that we put in internment camps. I prefer the interpretation of Romans 13 from our 16th century Anabaptist forebearers, like Thomas Munzer, who said, if the authorities render perverted judgment, Christians should deny this judgment as wrong and not tolerate it. For God demands an account of innocent blood. It is the greatest monstrosity, Munzer said, the greatest monstrosity on earth when no one wants to defend the plight of the needy. The Attorney General's appeal to God and the Apostle Paul failed to address two critical questions. First, must we really separate children from their parents? That seems like an unnecessarily punitive and heartless action. And second, even more importantly maybe, the question is, why are these immigrants crossing the border and breaking the law in the first place? Only someone with no hope of survival in their current situation would do it. What would possess someone to risk life and limb to walk across a dangerous desert facing dehydration, starvation, exhaustion, violence, exploitation, rape, and possibly being separated indefinitely from their children? Why would any human being do that? Dom Helder Camara famously said, when I feed the poor, they call me a saint. When I ask why they are poor, they call me a communist. We don't like to ask the question why. Because when we ask the question why, we often discover truths we would rather not know. Why are these people breaking the law and crossing the border? Well, because they are fleeing from poor and violent, unstable countries. And why are these countries poor and violent and unstable? Sadly, there is a history there that shows that it is often because we involved ourselves as a nation in their government and their economies. Starting in 1950 and throughout the Cold War, the U.S. military and the CIA were involved in disrupting economies, tampering with fair elections, arming rebel forces, assassinating democratically elected leaders, and influencing regime change in 22 of the 33 countries in South America, in order to, of course, stop the spread of communism. These actions destabilized the entire region, leading to civil wars, oppressive dictatorships, economic devastation, extreme poverty, and the mass migration of people looking for food and safety and economic sustainability. And of course, where did they go? But to their closest neighbor. People are crossing our border and breaking the law because we, in many ways, disabled their countries. And now they are desperate for food and clean water and safety and relief. They risk death because they are desperate for life. In many cases, they are desperate for a way of life that we took from them through political, military, or economic means. They cross the border, desperately looking for what we've taken. And we act like we're surprised that they're here. We shouldn't be surprised. Nor should we demonize them, hurt them, or separate them from their children. I sometimes feel like we lack the empathy to put ourselves in their shoes and ask that simple question. Maybe Father's Day will bring it home for us. What would I do if my family was in that situation. If you were living in abject poverty with no hope, if you and your children were starving, unsafe, at risk, in a violent environment, what would you do? Would you be willing to take a treacherous journey, cross a border, possibly break the law if it came to that, to save your family? Yes, many of us would do exactly the same thing if our family were facing those distressing circumstances. We're so quick to criminalize people and call them illegal, but we forget that a lot of what we call illegal crime is the result of economic factors. Nobody grows up wanting to be a prostitute. It happens when you have no other options to feed or provide for your family. Even dealing drugs like cocaine, heroin, or meth are often ways that poor communities create an economy where one doesn't exist so they can survive. This is not to justify those activities, but it can help us to consider how people got into those situations, to consider for a moment the human side. Jesus didn't hang out with prostitutes and tax collectors simply because he loved to party. I think he understood how they got into these situations. He just understood the economic pressures that forced human beings into particular ways of life to break the law for the sake of their livelihood and for their families, like our immigrant brothers and sisters at the border. Jesus regularly broke the law, and he was executed for it. But why did he break the law on this particular occasion? When the Pharisees confronted him about the disciples picking grain, Jesus referenced an obscure text in 1 Samuel 21 as precedent and said, "Don't you remember that David entered the temple when Abiathar was high priest and ate the holy bread, which was not lawful for anyone but the priest to eat? And then he gave some to his companions," almost as if to say, "So David did it, so I'm doing it." But the problem with Jesus' reference is it's not a great comparison. David and his companions came and asked the high priest for permission, asked the priest for bread. And the priest said, "All I have is this holy bread, but even though it is against the law, if you and your companions are holy people, you're welcome to have it." So the context of the stories is very different. But they do have two things in common. In both cases, people break the law in order to eat bread. And in both cases, the reason they break the law is because they were hungry. Jesus even mentions hunger in reference to David, which is not even in the original story. So we're led to believe this is all about hunger. Jesus and the disciples were hungry, and that's why they broke the law. On a bitterly cold day in February of 1846, a French writer was on the way to work when he saw something that affected him profoundly and changed the course of Western history. A gaunt and emaciated young man was being led away brutally by the police, arrested for stealing a loaf of bread. He was dressed in mud-spattered clothes, his bare feet thrust into clogs, his ankles wrapped in bloodied rags in lieu of stockings. The French writer who saw that boy taken away was Victor Hugo. And anyone who's read or watched Les Miserables will eventually recognize the wretched scene as the story of Jean Valjean, an out-of-work peasant who steals a loaf of bread in order to feed not just himself, but his sister and her seven children. And for his crime, Valjean is sentenced to 5 years of hard labor. Much of Hugo's famous novel turns on that one desperate act, and he uses that loaf of bread to challenge the society at the time's conscience and to highlight the injustice of their system. After describing the theft, he breaks into the story and makes a narrator's intervention and says this: "English statistics prove that 4 out of 5 thefts in London have hunger as their immediate cause." Hugo's highlighting the economic cause of the crime at the time. He fought the social justice of poverty his whole life, and he was writing at a time when children were being imprisoned for even minor offenses like stealing peaches. And he wanted to alert people that something had to be done about the poor. There was no sharper marker of economic status in 19th century France than bread.
The country was divided into the rich who ate soft white bread and the poor who ate coarse black bread made from rye, which bakers at the time would mix with sawdust and tree bark and other additives, making it so hard that the poor had to cut it up with an axe and soak it for 24 hours before they could eat it. Bread was a radical symbol in the shadow of the French Revolution. A string of failed harvests had caused an acute bread shortage and spiraling prices. And whether or not Marie Antoinette actually said, "Let them eat cake," the rumblings that led to the storming of the Bastille started with bread riots. Bread was a symbol for hunger and justice. Which is why Hugo wrote, "Whenever men go in ignorance or despair, and whenever women sell themselves for bread, wherever children lack a book to learn or a warm hearth, lame as a Roblin knocks at the door and says, 'Open up. I am here for you.'" Are things all that different today? Nearly 1 billion people in the world are poor. 47 million Americans live below the poverty line. There are 1.5 million poor people in North Carolina alone, and 129,224 people living below the poverty line right here in Charlotte. And we know now that they have the worst odds in the nation of moving out of poverty in their lifetime. Meanwhile, the wealthiest people in America saw their income surge in 2017 by $762 billion, which is enough money to end hunger and extreme poverty throughout the whole world seven times over, according to Oxfam. In fact, the top richest people earned enough last year in 1 year to end hunger and extreme poverty. It's not a matter of ability or resources. It's a matter of will. Desmond Tutu said, "When people were hungry, Jesus didn't say, 'Now, is that political? Is that social? Or is that spiritual?' No. Instead, Tutu says, Jesus said, 'I will feed you.' Because the good news to a hungry person is always bread." Likewise, Chilean poet Pablo Neruda once wrote, "How simple are you, O bread, how profound, familiar to every mouth. But if we plant your seed and grow it not for one, but for all, there will be enough. There will be bread for all the peoples of the earth. And we will share with one another whatever then has the shape and the flavor of bread. The earth itself, beauty and love, all taste like bread and have its shape. The germination of wheat. Everything exists to be shared, to be freely given, to multiply. Then life will have the shape of bread, deep and simple, immeasurable and pure. Every living thing will have its share of soil and life, and the bread we eat each morning will be hollow and sacred because it will have been won by the longest and costliest of human struggles." You know, Jesus is not going to ask us, "Did you follow the law of the land?" That's not what Matthew 25 says. We are told he's going to look at us and say, either, "I was hungry and you fed me. I was thirsty and you gave me something to drink." Or he'll look at us and say, "I was hungry and you did not feed me. I was thirsty and you did not give me something to drink." Jesus aligned himself with the poor and the hungry because he had a set of theological, political, social, and spiritual convictions that is sorely missing in our world today, that has been lost, abandoned, disappeared from our society, which few of us can even barely comprehend. Jesus said to the Pharisees, "The Sabbath was made for humanity, not humanity for the Sabbath." The highest law you can imagine was made for people, not people for the law. Jesus was saying that people are more important than the law, that God made the laws for people, and not the other way around. People come before the law. What does Jesus' teaching mean? It means that religious laws or political laws or laws that are both political and religious should exist to serve people and not hurt or oppress people. It means that if a law makes people suffer with hunger, for instance, that a law is evil and must not be carried out. It means that it is not always a sin to betray the law, but it is always a sin to betray people. Jesus' teaching means that laws, religious or otherwise, should always be for the people. It means that if there is a law that benefits some people but hurts others, then Jesus opposes it. It means that if there is a law that benefits religious people but hurts others, Jesus opposes it. It means that if there is a law that benefits politicians but hurts people, Jesus opposes it. It means that if there is a law that benefits corporations but hurts people, Jesus opposes it. And Jesus was not talking about laws that hurt people's feelings or opinions or sensibilities, but laws that hurt people's bellies and bodies and bank accounts. There are certain laws that Jesus was simply willing to break. He was willing to break any law that was breaking the backs of his people. Period. God does not affirm laws simply because they are put in place by authorities, as our Attorney General claimed. God only affirms laws that are created for and serve humanity, for the benefit of human beings, for the poor, the hungry, and the oppressed. The Sabbath was created for that very reason, for human beings, for human creativity, for human rest, for human liberation, for human peace, for human justice, for human joy, for human delight. It was not created for some humans, like the Pharisees, to enjoy while other people go hungry. It was created for all humans to enjoy, for total human flourishing, which is why any law that does not lead to the flourishing of all human beings, whether they be rich or poor, black or white, male or female, straight, gay, Republican, Democrat, citizen or immigrant, Christian or non-Christian, is an immoral and unjust law that the followers of Jesus must oppose. Either a law is for the benefit of all people, or it is not from God. That is what Jesus was teaching the Pharisees. If people are hungry on the Sabbath, don't get caught up in the law. Just feed the hungry, and you fulfill the Sabbath. You fulfill the highest law. The Sabbath is not sacred because it's a law. It's sacred because it requires that we care for other human beings. Laws are not sacred. People are sacred. So the question we have to ask ourselves as followers of Jesus is, are people more important to us than our laws? Or are our laws more important to us than people? Caring for people more than we care about the law, that's what Jesus called love. And in Galatians, Paul said, there is no law against love. In fact, if you read a little further in Romans 13, which I hope all of you will do, you will discover that the whole chapter is really about love triumphing over the law. In Romans 13:10, Paul says, love does no wrong to a neighbor, for love is the fulfillment of the law. You'll remember Jesus said it too. All of the law, he said, hangs on these two commandments. Love God with all your heart, soul, mind, and body, and love your neighbor as yourself. Without love, we are nothing. Our laws are nothing. Nothing but noisy gongs and clanging cymbals. And so, beloved, let us love one another. For love is what truly comes from God, and not our laws. Amen.